that I think one of the things that happens when you decide, sorry, one of the mechanisms that charitable organizations have is that they have to give you frequent flyer points in some way for doing the right thing. So, you know, if you say that you're going to donate to Girls and Boys Club of Canada, if that's even a thing anymore, I don't know. And they say you'll get a receipt for $25 for a $25 contribution, and you'll get a baseball cap emblazoned with our whatever, right?
Right.
And it's funny. That's not a motivator for me. And I don't like that as a motivator, because I think to myself, so I give you $25. How much of my $25 does it take for you to give me back a baseball cap? Right. But I think that there's a transactional kind of relationship that we have with some of these charitable foundations where we do expect something back. And, you know, any of the sort of points cards or what's that called? My brain wants to say dedicated buyer, but it's not a dedicated buyer. What's that called? Like where you're a
preferred buyer or something.
Yeah. Where you're like a preferred customer or something like that. And you get a discount or you get like, that's good. That's, I get that from some place that's trying to make money and they're trying to figure out a way to keep you as a customer, preferred customer kind of a thing. But when it comes to a charitable organization, if I'm going to give my net cash to you, I want to know that you're receiving my net cash. So back to what you're saying, like those sort of donations at the till, if I don't know of the charitable foundation and I don't know of your filter system to get them the money, mm-hmm. I'll say no at the first time, right on the front end. Now there are some places that I've looked into and I can see that that most of the money goes right to the charitable foundation. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that, you know, it tends to be based on some of the places I shop more frequently. Right. So there is some, I think the local Metro runs something for snack programs for schools. So I know that one, a large percentage of it gets there. There's another one, as you mentioned, when we were chatting before about books and stuff like that, but I'll go home and I'll do the research. And I try to make sure that my discipline of being charitable is in alignment with my belief that if I'm going to be given my money, it's got to go, like most of it has to go to the actual person behind the business, right? So, you know, the No Frills is asking me for, you know, a dollar for something. I want to know that 80 cents of that dollar, 90 cents of that dollar is going directly to the charitable foundation and not to the overhead costs of that business to sort of set up a structure to receive the money from me. It reminds me a lot. So here's the thing. And so, okay. So we started off by talking about gratuity in restaurants and whether or not individuals are tipping right now and what their perception of why they tip, who they're tipping, you know, when they go for their takeout or curbside pickup. So here's my experience from restaurants. So I've worked in restaurants where the tip that you give at the table, so you as the customer, that tip goes into a tip pool. It doesn't actually go into the pocket of the server. Now, this may be a big reveal for people, all of our listeners, side note, sometimes that tip, doesn't go directly to the server. So all those tips are calculated at the end of the day. What's interesting is that the tip, regardless of if it's cash or otherwise, is expected to go into the tip pool. And then that tip pool is divided up amongst the staff. Okay. So it's divided up amongst the staff, all staff. So this can kind of skew your perception of the, you know, where your money's going when you hand it to the server at the end. So a couple different things. Can I go off on this for a sec just to sort of shape it out? Man,
go okay. for it.
So here's the, some of the sort of insider stuff. So the tip pool then is divided amongst, back of the house staff, front of the house staff. So anyone that's maybe joining in, just to sort of a brief update. So prior to becoming a teacher, I was a chef. I'd worked in hospitality since I was 13 years old. Didn't start teaching until 2004, and I'm really old. So I've still spent almost more year. I've spent more years working in hospitality than I have as a teacher, which is kind of mind blowing, right? Because age 13 to, well, however I was in, I think 2004 or five, I was in the restaurant biz. Back to what about the money. So the money gets divided up amongst the staff. That gets sort of subdivided based on, like you get a percentage of that tip pool. Each area gets a different percentage. So, and you get tip pool based on the number of hours that you work. Okay. So it gets sort of sliced down that way. Oftentimes what happens is, the server is expected. So if the tip doesn't go directly into literally a bucket to be divided up, typically the way it goes is that as a server, a percentage of your tip you have to pay out to the house. And that's what goes to the tip pool, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you make $100, your tip out, as it's called, would be a percentage of that. So you make $100. I don't even remember the number. I can't even remember the number, but you know, we used to have to calculate it at the end of the night. I was a closing manager, not only a managing chef. So I would be doing cash out at the end of the night with the servers. And I would quite literally be taking a percentage of their tips and putting it into the safe. And that was part of the tip pool, like a bank. So that all gets divided up. Now, what's interesting about this is that us as the managers also got a tip pool. So as a manager, I'd be getting a cut of the server's wages. And this is where it gets kind of murky, right? Because, you know, if you're, and I'll kind of, I'm trying to flip back and forth between our perception of tipping now when we're at the restaurant as customers and the mechanisms of sort of the things that are happening behind the scenes. I wonder offhand, you know, how many people are aware that, you know, there could be a tip pool. And I don't know if you do this, but I do this often when I'm doing purchases. I will often ask, are you on commission? So I'll ask the actual salesperson. I've done this for almost every big purchase that I've done. I don't often do it if I'm sort of heading in just to kind of get groceries, obviously. But if there's a salesperson walking the floor or there's someone that spends time with me and I feel like I get their hourly should cover the fact that they approach me and start talking to me. But if I feel like they are humanizing me and humoring me and are kind of aware, you know, they kind of back off. They sort of back in and back off well. They're not just constant high pressure. Then I'll ask the next question, are you on commission? Are you on commission here? Because I've realized that I'm willing to pay for the relationship, right? I'm willing to pay the premium for this relationship. If I don't get the sense like you're rocking this relationship well, I'll never ask if you're on commission because I'm thinking to myself, thank you for the information. And then I go on to the next salesperson. So I take what you've taught me and I move on. Or I take what you've taught me and I go to your competitor. So that's just the way that I work as a consumer, let's say. But the last thing I just want to say about the tip pool is that I think that that's what started my, that's what's in the background of my operating system when I think about charitable donation, is that I'm aware that there could be other grabby hands behind the scenes that are going to take a cut of that. And in the same way you go and you do your curbside pickup, there could be grabby hands in the background too that are saying, okay, you're rounding up or rounding down to help out the restaurant maybe, or you're rounding up. No, sorry, you don't round down.
I'd love to be able to round down.
Yeah, you don't round down. You round, only the pennies get rounded up or rounded down, right? But the actual gratuity, or let's say the extra commission part on it, you round up. I think I operate in a much the same way as you, is that if I when as soon as I get, and I do think this is the obligation of the business, as soon as I get the feels that they are reaching out to build a relationship with me that's not just dependent on handing me my burger, I get into the gratuity zone. That's the tripwire for me. As soon as I get the sense that they're willing to sort of see me, and I get it, this can all be a mirage too, because good salespeople do this. They make you feel good. But sometimes I don't care. I figure that's just like, that is what I want to do. I want to feel good about the purchase. I want to feel good about buying a new TV. I want to feel good about getting ribs. I want to feel good about my grocery shopping experience. And it's easy to sort of start by the fact of like, oh, I hate spending money. But if someone makes me forget that for a moment, then I figure they're probably doing their job right. And that's where I start to get into the gratuity zone. So.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I know I hit record in the middle of your talk, but I did that on purpose because I wanted to just flow right in. I didn't want to cut you off or rejig anything, but basically we're decoding the whole gratuity thing. And it started with me talking to Chris about getting dinner last night and feeling.
This is season 4, episode 20. The Dakota podcast. He's Roland Chidiak. I'm Chris Clough.
It's like we've switched places.
Yeah, welcome.
That's awesome. I don't.
Whoever's listening, and welcome.
Yeah, we have two people listening. Sweet. Or at least that's what the computer says. But we have Tyler Keefe from Idaho. I hope I got that right, Tyler, from Idaho. He's saying happy Saturday, Ratterday. His wife and him. His wife works for a nonprofit, and they've had this exact same conversation. She agrees with you, Clough. The money should go directly to the cause.
So I'm doing the right thing. There we go. That nonprofit just made me feel good. But I appreciate that I'm in alignment with the. I like that I'm thinking right. And I try to encourage people to think that way too. There is an element I think in my. I just go back to where I stand on this is when I'm working. The work that I do is to make sure that I don't let my own privilege become invisible to me. My awareness of my own privilege means that I have to wind that around my operating system of how I move through the world. If I use my privilege then as sort of like fuel for how I move through the world, then what that means is when the opportunity is presented to me to be charitable or just to give or to help, I don't feel like anything is being taken from me. I don't feel like I have to spend the time deciding, am I a good person or a bad person? I just act, right? So that's what's more important to me than scrutinizing in the moment. And I think that's why I also have that sort of like that automatic nope, but I'm going to check you out. And I have the discipline of checking you out and I make a mental note. So when I'm back in that space again, I know what I'm saying. It's not even decision anymore, but what I'm saying yes or no to. So, but yeah, you were throwing down about picking up that, I want to say it, breakfast blues and barbecue, picking up some food and just mentioning, you know, you roll in there and they say your name. They say your name. And that definitely is. And I wondered as you were saying that, like, have you noticed when you go in for a pickup now, it seems like just the essential people are working in the kitchen. Like you're sort of looking back and you're like, we'd call that a skeleton crew, right? When I'm looking at, it's funny. I think back to my restaurant experience and the crew that you would keep on between because the restaurants, well, I've worked at different restaurants, but often the crew that you keep through the afternoon, there's something called the split shift. And the split shift, I know it from hospitality. It's kind of where you're in for lunch and then you have a few hours off and you come back for dinner, but you got to keep some staff in between. Now, where I did my apprenticeship, there were no servers that stayed on through the split because the actual front of the house wasn't open. The dining room wasn't open. We were just in the back doing prep. But the last restaurant that I was at, we were open through the afternoon. And often the staff that you keep on through the split shift have to be some of your strongest staff. Because you're really reducing the number of people in order to reduce your costs because you're not making as many sales as you do right over the lunch break and over the dinner break, but you still have walk-ins. You have people that are just going to show up and see you kind of doing your thing. And you have to keep the people in there that are able to maintain the standard of service and product and connection that you want to keep projecting. And I'm just getting wild right now at the skeleton crew that different businesses are able to keep in and keep that connection going. And I think a big part of it is they're having to find ways like they did with you when you came in. They're not just taking your phone number and You know, you walk in, yeah, I'm like, da-da, like, set down your mobile number, and they're like, okay, here's your food. You're making the order, and they'll say, okay, who's picking up the food? Can we get a name for it? I mean, Starbucks started doing this back in the day tons of time, just to make you feel good about you giving you the money, right? They call out your name, here's your thing. You're not customer 2753. You get to be Roland, and they see you and you felt seen. So walking in, dude, this small joint that you'd mentioned, like family joints, and then calling out, hey, Roland, not are you Roland? Or is Roland in here? They're naming you by name. And that's a restaurant that is running their skeleton crew. This is what I think. They're running their skeleton crew. They're really being shrewd and making sure they're maintaining their business. Cause if it's family business, that's their business is feeding them too, not just you. And they're aware that that type of investment is kind of where the industries are at. You have to be offering that. And I don't know if it, I think a lot of the hospitality services right now are, they're, I would imagine they're struggling with their dependency on gratuities. Because back in the past, you could easily justify it because you're kind of coming into their house. You're coming into their house and you're experiencing an event. The event now is so small. It's a point and click or tap experience. So how do you build what used to feel like a, you know, what you used to be able to do as a server or as a restaurant with the cool jazz music that you're playing or the big comfy chairs or the manager dropping by and say, you know what, I've seen you in here before. We're going to buy your appetizer today. Like, so all these little kind of like checkpoints that ultimately would make you say, oh my gosh, I'm going to give this place $20 tip. Like I'm going to pay more. This was so good. Now it has to be done with a point and click and tap. And I really appreciate the fact that and this is my old hospitality genes kicking in, that you felt a little bit of a connection when you went into that joint because they named you and called you out. They knew you were coming. I hope the food matched up. It sounded like, as you described it, yeah, you're throwing a thumbs up. I love the names and what you guys ordered. I'd be down for that exact same order that you mentioned. I'm wondering if at any point we're going to swing this idea of gratuity and kind of who's benefiting behind that extra effort, if there's a way for us to swing it back to our thoughts on education right now.
Well, let's make the swing.
Okay, swing
it. What would that look like in EDU? What would that look like? It's almost like...
Was that too abrupt? Does that feel like there's a... Is there... We can move it there, you think?
I don't know. Do you want to talk about my experience?
Yeah.
I don't care. Like, I...
Yeah, you... I am curious about, you know... I am... If you have other things to sort of, like, drop as far as that food, or maybe even... Because I know you have a... I think you have a sort of like a family tradition of kind of getting the pickup. Like you've mentioned that before, that, you know, so Friday nights is kind of like, hey, you know, where are we going? Where are we going to,
right?
Where are we eating tonight? Yeah. And I told you before, like your neck of the woods has a really nice array of foods, I think mine, where I'm in New York region, it's evolving and more stuff is popping up. You have a far more diverse selection of stuff and kind of interesting, I find, stuff. So, but I'm just wondering, that whole practice of getting the takeout, if you felt any shifts in your dedication or connection to where you're picking stuff up.
100%. I'll tell you, there are certain places I won't go to. Like if the family wants, I can't think of any right now, but if the family says, can we get this? I'm like, I'm not picking it up. That's my protest to, I don't want to eat that food or from that place anymore. I can't think of, oh, okay. I won't name the place, but there is so I'm Middle Eastern, Lebanese background, an Armenian background. So I'm, you know, Armenian Lebanese is where my parents are. And, I have this issue with Middle Eastern restaurants, or I have a stereotype about them. And my wife tells me all the time, it's not fair what you're doing, but I do it anyway. So, God, I can't believe I'm going to say it, but I am. So in my head, Middle Eastern restaurants, in my experience as well, they make great Food. Most of them make great food. It reminds me of being at home. It reminds me of my mom's cooking. But their service is horrible. They just don't, in my opinion, they don't pay enough attention to the customer. They don't pay attention to the details. And I like that. I'm a detail kind of guy. So there's this one place, and I have to be careful because I don't want to name them, but there's this one place, their food is delicious. It's absolutely delicious. Everybody in the family agrees. We love their food. I refuse to go because I refuse to go and pick up the food because there's, I would say, 7 times out of 10, they've made a mistake with the order. It's like, well, who do you have working for you that you can't get these orders right? Why don't you pay attention to the details? Why do we always have to call and complain? Like, and that sucks too, right? The calling and complaining, it sucks. But it's gone to the point where it's like, well, no, I paid for something and I didn't get what I paid for. So you're gonna fix it. I'll give you. So anyway, Middle Eastern restaurants. Now when we're getting Middle Eastern, I tend to say to the family, just tell me what you want to order and I will go to the store and I will literally order it there. I don't want to call it in because they're going to make a mistake over the phone. So I'm not calling it in. I'll just go and stand there for 40 minutes as they make the food or whatever. I'm good. But now there's one or two places that I just won't go to. And my wife knows. So she'll be like, okay, we're getting such and such. And I'll throw my hands up. She's like, don't worry, I'll go pick it up. I'm like, great. You can call it in and you can deal with the 7 out of 10, which is bad. Like 70% is great to most people. When it comes to restaurant food, I just want to get my food, sit down and eat it. I don't want to have to call anybody. I don't want to have to. The best is we'll come back, we'll fix it. No, I'm not coming back. No, I'm not going back. So
One and done. One and done.
Yeah,
You want just one and
tell
done.
me what you're gonna do. And either next time I get it, you give it to me right for nothing, or we do some money thinking, like I'm not going back. And I know, so I want to shift a little bit and say that I know that this culture of this has become crazy. Like there's a couple of Facebook groups that my wife and I belong to in our region about, it's all about food and restaurants in our region. And there's a tendency, it appears, that people go off the handle right away and post their issues on social media rather than call the restaurant first and explain your situation, see what comes of it. And okay, so lots of people, the restaurant people don't like that because they're like, hey, you didn't even reach out. You didn't even reach out to try to get us to help you, and you're slamming us on socials. Like we made a mistake, we're sorry, but could you talk to us first? So this is important because in the summer, so every summer we have this new tradition in my, well, it's not new, it's like, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years old. Every summer, there's a Kitchener Rib Fest. There's also a Cambridge Rib Fest, and we try to attend both, but Kitchener Rib Fest is a big one. It's at Victoria Park, which is a big park here in Kitchener. And we go, and it's a family thing. Like we bring Sarah's sister comes with her family and her parents come, and they've got these huge round tables. So we divide and conquer. Each one of us goes to a different river and we grab the ribs, we come back and we eat like kings and queens. In fact, I take pride. I have a backpack, a Rib Fest backpack that I bring. It's got the paper towels, it's got the drink, it's got the
That's awesome.
towelettes, it's
It's
got
like the old baby
cutlery.
bag, right?
Yeah.
It's the baby bag, but for adults. I can
And
remember that. You
yeah.
got the wipes. You might have a little bit of the hand sanitizer. Maybe a couple snacks just in case. Or an old snack pack that you even forgot that's in there. Some French fries from the last Rib Fest. I love it.
It's
On the
beautiful
water.
because, yeah, everything. So, yeah, there's water, there's drink, like pop, everything you need to have a good rib fat. There's paper plates and cutlery, like everything. Okay. I've got it all. And so this year, because of the pandemic, they did like a drive-through system. So you pull up, they did it at the Kitchener Auditorium. So it's a big rink with a lot of parking. So they set it up so that you pull in and you come up to the gate and you tell them which river you want to buy from, and then they direct you down a lane. So I go down this lane, and I did my research, and we picked the best river that, you know, based on our experience and everybody's talk. We get the food. We ordered a lot of food because I was not only getting food from my family, I was getting it from my in-laws. So I ordered, like, you know, 2.5 meals type of thing with all the extras or whatever. I get to my in-laws' house. I give them their food. And then I come home and I take my food out and I see that I'm missing a whole rack of ribs. And that's a big deal, bro, because they're expensive and the whole family is like when we do Rib Fest, we go hard. Like, we just eat because it tastes so good, and we only do it once a year, twice a summer kind of thing. So I'm so disappointed. Like, my family's looking at me and they're like, dude, dad's going to cry. Like, dad's mad and sad at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it was raining, right? It's pouring rain. So it's like, I'm not.
You're getting poetic now. You're adding, what is that called? I think it's a literary term, psychological term, where the outside bad weather kind of matches your inside bad weather. Right. And you kind of say, of course it's raining outside on the day where I'm having the worst mood ever. Or, you know, you look and see that the ribs are missing in. You look outside the window and the clouds just go over the sun. The sky gets dark. And you're like, that's exactly how I feel.
I wonder if any of this will trigger you to write a poem. But anyway.
It might.
Who knows? So anyway, it's pouring rain. We're in the middle of a pandemic. All I want is Rib Fest with the family. So this is what happens. So I'm pissed and I'm sad. But I know the lady who owns the promotional company that's behind the Kitchener Rib Fest. Great lady. It's funny, I think one year they called me their unofficial ambassador because I was tweeting about it all the time. And they showed me some love, right? Like, I got a tweet saying, hey, when you come to Rib Fest with your family, come on over to this trailer and ask for me. I've got something for you. And I remember getting this wicked, like, gift basket. Rib Fest gift basket, because they appreciated what I was doing on Twitter for them. And I was like, hey, I love your food. I love your service. Anyway, so I Facebook message her and I say to her, hey, okay, I got a problem. Can you help me? I went to this river. I bought all this food. I'm missing a whole rack of ribs. Can you help me fix it? She's like, of course I can. So she says, just give me 5 minutes or whatever. She messages the guy who runs that river trailer and tells him, and then the first response is, can you come back? And I said, I'm not going back. And now here's a good thing, right? Because I'm ready to lose my mind, but I have a relationship with this lady and she's been nothing but awesome for years, right? Nothing but awesome for years. And I would consider her a friend in a way, a weird way. She's a friend. So I tell her, no, I'm not going back. I'm not getting in my car, going in the rain to get a rack of ribs. I'm just not doing it. She's like, no problem. So then she puts me in contact with the river and he basically says, I'll just refund you your money. I said, okay, I'll take it. Like, thank you. So now I'm out of the ribs, but I'm not going back to get the ribs. And the man says, well, I can give you back your money. If you can't come, I understand. I'll just give you back what you paid. And I said, nay, no problem. I get the e-transfer and it's all done. We're missing some ribs, whatever, we make do. But, you know, then she checks in with me. She's like, did everything go well? And I said, yeah, everything went well. He was very kind. He refunded me the money. Thank you for your help. And she was like, she wrote a paragraph about how she appreciated the fact that I didn't just go and roast everybody on social media, that I actually reached out, that she's more than happy to help. She's very disappointed that it happened to me, but unfortunately it happens, which I understand, and she fixed it. So it's like, I will always, unless something really bad happens, I will always support Kitchener Rib Fest. I will always support that marketing team that puts the show together, because they treat me like a human. They don't just dismiss my issue. And because I know this lady, I know she works hard. You know, she's a family person. She's just doing her thing, just like I'm doing my thing every day. So I wanted to drop that. But this whole, the whole gratuity thing started with, you know, you go to a restaurant to pick up your food, especially these days, and the machine asks you for a tip right off the hop. There's no option to not, there's no option to refuse to, I've never seen it say no tip. It either, it gives you percentages and then it gives you a money amount. So I just press the money amount and then punch in the zeros because I'm not tipping you, especially when you force me to, I'm not doing it. Now this
it's place, the perception. It's what the irony here is that it's the perception of being forced. It introduces, I think, a way of thinking that's a little bit alien to your state of mind at the time.
Sure.
And I think that that dissonance can mess with you. You know, you sort of cue into, wait, what conversation are we having right now? I thought I was actually just paying like I would at a convenience store to a degree. You give me the thing, I give you the money. Now you're introducing this other element from what seems like a dissonant space. So you're going to introduce the idea of a gratuity in a moment where there's been no, it doesn't jive with what I think our criteria for offering a gratuity is.
So I use the word force because I'm paying. I have to pay for my food.
Yeah.
But they're not giving me an option out. Yeah. I mean, there is an option out. You have to think about it. You have to stop and think. You have to think, oh, 15, 18, 20% or money. Well, if I press money and just enter in zero, then that's what they're getting. But not that that has to happen quick. And not everybody's going to process that. They're just going to be like, oh, shoot, I have to pay. I guess I better... If I want to do this, I'll give 15% or whatever. You hit the money, you give $2-3. I don't know. But it feels like you're being forced because at the moment, it seems like there's no way out. You really have to stop and think. And again, that's hard. If there's people behind you waiting to get their food and pay, now you're the doofus taking up that time. Like there's layers here. There's layers for some people. For me, there's a lot of layers.
Having to work that hard for an opt-out feels uncomfortable.
Yes. So, but this restaurant, I saw it and I'm like, yeah, I got no problem tipping you. You make great food, in my opinion, because before when we got the food there, they wouldn't even let us in their restaurant. You had to pay over the phone with your credit card. Then when you got to the restaurant, you'd stand on their porch. They'd open the door and ask you who you were. Then they bring your food out and you already paid online. You already paid like over the phone. So they just like, here's your food. Have a great night. They wouldn't even let you in because it was early still in the pandemic. We didn't know. People didn't know how to navigate it. Right. So, but now, you know, I walked in and the lady who answers, she's the one at the front of the house and her husband's the one in the kitchen. So you're talking skeleton crew. There's two of them. So when I called in, she said, what time do you want to pick up your food? I said, can I pick it up at 5? She goes, hold on, let me check with my, and she named her husband. Let me check with him. She goes, this is the order, 5? He's like, no, 5:15. I got people coming at 5, and I don't want, well, we can't have a lot of people in the building, and I don't want people waiting long for their food. So can we do 5:15? This is all happening while I'm on the phone.
Yeah.
And she's like, 5:15. I'm like, oh, hell yeah. She's like, thank you. We appreciate your understanding. It's only 15 minutes, but hey, that's cool that you're treating me like this, right? So when I did get there, I got there around 5:12, 5:13. I come in, she's like, Roland, how are you? I'm like, I'm good, thank you. She goes, your food's just coming up. And I can hear him in the back saying, I've got the crispy chicken. You know, he's literally packaging my food at that time. So I know my food's going to be hot at 5:15. Got my food at 5:20. I don't care because it was piping hot. And I love that. That's a pet peeve of mine, to pick up the food when it's actually being packaged and it's hot. So I got my food nice and hot. The helpings are great. The people are good. So when it was time to provide a tip, I had no issue. I'm happy to support a place like that that's going to treat me well, feed me well. And you know what? They're local. They're not a franchise. They're a mom-pa kind of place. I'm happy to support that.
Yep.
So there's a lot. I am privileged, but I'm not just going to be throwing my money around. I'm not that privileged, you know. I need to think about where my money goes, but I'm happy to give money to those causes. And just like, you know, I told you about Ronald McDonald House and how my family's happy to give to Ronald McDonald House because we actually lived there. The summer that my oldest was born, he was a preemie. He had a lot of issues. They couldn't deal with him here in Kitchener. They had to send him to a more specialized hospital, and we ended up in Hamilton at McMaster, which, oh man, like they were thinking about sending us to Windsor, Ottawa. Ottawa would have been fine. I would have just stayed with my mom, but like it was like, no, you have to leave. We can't help your son here. So we ended up in Hamilton, and we ended up living at the Ronald McDonald House in Hamilton, and it was, man, I have nothing negative to say. It was the most amazing experience. The people working there were so kind and compassionate. Everybody respected our privacy. We respected other people's privacy. Anything that we needed or wanted, they would assist. So it wasn't even slimy. Like the whole thing was just an amazing experience at such a shitty time in our lives. So when I go to McDonald's, and I do eat McDonald's, and they say, do you want to give to Ronald McDonald House or charity? I'm like, hell yeah, take my money. Like,
here you go.
What do you want? How much can I give you today? Because I actually lived it. And there was no expense spared. Like, the rooms were beautiful. The amenities were great. And mind you, at that time, my wife and I weren't thinking those things, right? We weren't thinking amenities and stuff. But for example, because we were living in Hamilton, when Sarah's parents and her sister would come to visit us, we would get takeout, and we would sit in the dining room area of the house. So it was basically a mansion. So it didn't feel like a restaurant. Like, so there was like a couches and a big screen TV and a bookshelf type area, and then right behind it were like a bunch of kitchen tables, right? So the food would come in, we would let our family into the building, we would sit in the kitchen, and we would eat a family style meal, and nobody would bother us. Nobody would get in our face. You know, when we saw other families doing it, they would just do their thing. We never got in their face. Like, it was very, very well run. And as I was telling you, it was like a casserole of humanity. There were all kinds of people there. You know, we would see, and we never got to know anybody really well in the house because it was like a weird time, right? So you never really, you'd be friendly to people when you see them in the kitchen or whatever, but you never, like, I never sat down with anybody and said, hey, I'm Roland, what's your name? It just didn't seem, our heads were in different spaces. So I would see what appeared to be like single moms for the week until the dad could come. We would see very young couples, like very young. And then we would see people older than us. And like I said, you look in the parking lot, you'd see Corvettes, you'd see jalopies, you'd see Honda Civics. Like, it was really a mix of humans there. And so, yeah, they want my money, they can have my money. Now, after leaving there, we would go back every summer and we would bring like a bunch of donuts or whatever and drop them off at the house. We haven't done anything in a while, but now that I'm talking to you about this,
I was wondering if it's lighting you up to.
It is. It's
reconnect.
I feel like I need to step up. We haven't done anything in a few years, so we should do something. And I'm sure my wife, she's all over it. So we will definitely do something to show our love for the Hamilton Ronald McDonald House.
That's cool. It's quite remarkable. I mean, all the connections that you made there, how that stemming from gratuity, eh? Like, I love all the kind of like rolling thinking coming out of it. I think maybe our and I told you in our on-ramped just the whole, like, how happy I am for you that you have that you having that memory it's like a gift, because the fact that you have the memory means that you received the help you needed when you needed it. So, and that's no small thing. That's no small thing. I'll say, especially, you know, when it comes to the things that we feel are in our control and out of our control. So all those things that we can feel like out of our control, I'm starting to believe that it might not be in my control, but damn, I sure hope it's in somebody else's control. Like, I hope the things that are out of my control are actually in somebody else's hands to help me out. So that's, I like that. I deeply appreciate that you received that when you needed it.
I did. And that house at that time was a blessing. And like, I'm telling you, man, I'm thinking back, everything about it, like, we didn't have any issues with privacy or like nothing. They literally gave us everything we needed when we would go to the front desk. And it was funny too, because most of the people working there were volunteers.
Yeah, I think that's a major part of their framework. I think
lots of volunteers. So lots of people that you walk to the office, you don't know who's going to be in there, and you tell them, hey, this is my issue, can you help or whatever? They're like, yeah, for sure, we can do this and this, or we can take care of that or whatever. It just was, it was good feels. And we didn't, you know, my wife and I didn't, you know, we wouldn't sit in the living room and watch television. Like, we just stayed to our room or the kitchen or the dining area where we could sit with our family and eat and chat, because, you know, our son couldn't really have visitors at that time. So the whole thing's just whacked out. But, Tim's in the house from Teachers on Fire. Thanks for joining us, Tim. It's you and Tyler Keefe at the moment. So, hey, we appreciate your time. Thanks for checking us out. Mm-hmm. Let's shift into gratuities to education. I don't even know what that might look like. The first thing I think of, though, is Christmas gifts and year-end gifts, like ways that families thank you. And it's not, obviously not necessary. And I know some teachers that at Christmas time and end of the year are like literally are what's the word I want to use? The gratuities come flying in at them. I've seen
that. They're rolling out. They're walking down to the office to get
the cart,
to get the old LCD cart, because they're rolling out with a Santa's bag full of swag.
Right, right. So. Yeah, or, you know, they're leaving, they're going to their car at lunch because there's so much they have to get half of it out at lunch. Half at the end of the day.
Making two runs. You know, the ones that are super ninja are the ones that already have like the big plastic bins in the back of their car, because they know they're going to have to kind of keep that stuff from rolling around in the back of their car. So they pop the trunk and you know what I mean? It looks like, it looks like they're ready to go get groceries. They have all their containers ready.
So is that one way of looking at the whole gratuity thing for teachers?
I think so. But if I want to tie it, I think just a little bit closer to some of our discussion around seeing that tip button on the tap and go, the idea of the opt out. Mm-hmm. So that concept of the opt out right now feels like we can connect it to a bunch of different things that are going on in our adaptive and virtual learning spaces. Mm-hmm. I started a convo that I think I tagged you into. So maybe this will start the light up. You remember a few weeks back, we're talking about do your students, are they required to ask for permission?
Right, right.
And there was some good chatter that came up on Twitter around that. And I threw down a poll into Twitter, and there was quite an array. There mm-hmm. seemed to be, the two major things that kind of seem to be in tension with each other is a teacher's need to maintain a semblance of control.
Okay.
And the teacher's understanding that they have to maintain the dignity of the student. And when I was looking at the sort of like the results as they were popping up, that seemed to be the thing that people were kind of, you know, the two fires that people were huddling around. But there's a whole lot of dark space between there, right? Mm-hmm. And in order to cross from one to the other, I felt like people didn't want to commit. Because I didn't get a sense like anybody was able to do exactly what they wanted, which was to maintain control of the class, which feels like an expectation from our school boards, right? That we have to maintain class despite the fact the kids in their own home. And we also have to not overstep our boundaries as a teacher to say, no, you can't go to the bathroom because I'm in the middle of something, or we're in the middle of something here. Like, that's, it was tricky. So the opt-out, I think, might be a way for us to kind of access where we are. Like, flipping from the gratuity factor, what does that look like for students and families or teachers right now? What do we feel like we can opt out of? Because the sudden appearance of this virtual system, it really has set in motion. Like I said, I remember noticing the gratuity button, I think when I was at, where was I? It was a really, what it seemed like a random place, like at like the car, like it was a car wash or something, but it was like an automated car wash. And I just happened to be at the cash and I noticed on the thing that there was an option to do a gratuity. Now, admittedly, they did have some food in that space too. You know, they had a cooler where you could get a drink, but I noticed the gratuity and I thought, And then within a few months, everybody had the gratuity button popping up on their little cash and tap, you know, tap and go thing. There's a whole lot of stuff that's kind of automatically getting populated into our virtual spaces. Just the evolution of Brightspace D2L and like Google Classrooms, there's options that are popping out that are kind of in response to what people are asking for. And it's always a little bit of a surprise when that function pops up on the screen, right? It's a new thing you can do with it. So right now my brain is kind of, it's grabbing onto this idea of gratuity. And not gratuity, sorry, the gratuity, but leading to the opt-out. What do we feel like we can opt out of right now? Because it feels like there's so much that's being built into the system that is really outside of our control. And I'll say, I know that there are students that want to opt out. They still do not want to opt into this version of education. Still.
There are teachers that are not happy with what they're doing or what they're being told to do. I said this in a Facebook comment to somebody recently, and it boils down to this for me. We are making history right now, and we're going to look back on it and we're going to feel shame for what we did in education. I'm telling you right now, we're going to feel shame. We're going to feel we had an opportunity to do things a little bit differently. We had an opportunity to really focus on mental health and well-being, and we didn't. I don't think we are. People are walking around telling you to have grace. People are telling you you've got this, you can do this. They're saying that those are all Band-Aids. Those are all Band-Aids to help you feel a little bit better.
And bandwagons.
Right, bandwagons and Band-Aids. That'd be awesome title for the podcast today, but we spent half of it talking about restaurants, but bandwagons and Band-Aids. But so in my opinion, there's a lot going on right now in EDU, and there is an opt-out for certain people for certain things, but a lot of it is forced or perceived forced, right? There's a lot of things teachers are doing. There's a lot of things families are doing. There's a lot of things students are doing that they've been dropped on you at the last minute, right? When you're about to pay for your meal, and you have to pay for the meal. You can't reject the payment of the meal, but it's hard to think through the situation you're in because there are people behind you waiting to pick up and you need to just pay and go. And so you're doing stuff because it's there in front of you and you're told to just do it.
Tap and go.
Don't ask questions. Just do it. And, you know, I told a trusted colleague the other day, I don't know about everybody else, but I'm literally one lesson plan away from losing my mind.
Yeah.
You know, I'm one lesson plan away from losing my mind. I'm one online Google Meets glitch from just shutting the whole thing down, just not going to work. And I'm not saying that because I'm trying to be dramatic. I'm being honest. I'm being vulnerable. I'm ready to lose my friggin' mind. I'm exhausted like I've never been before. You know, I'm making my lesson plans. I'm creating things for the kids to work on. It's constant. It doesn't stop. And because I'm at home, there's the lack for me of separation of work and home. And, you know, my wife and I, we were having this conversation last night. She works in the dining room. So she literally is like, 10 steps away from the television. So when she goes to watch TV and take a break, her office is right behind her, and she knows she's not done. She's got a lot more work to do. And right now we're both working on report cards, and it's like we're literally dying. So yesterday I woke up. It was a PD day for us yesterday. So I woke up. I had a meeting at 9 a.m. Meeting was over at 10 a.m. And then from 10 to 1, I did report cards. And then I went downstairs. I had something to eat. I watched a little bit of TV. And then I worked for another hour and a half. And at the end of it, I said to my wife, "What are you doing now?" She goes, "I'm planning for the next week." And I kind of rubbed my forehead. And she's like, "What's wrong?" And I was like, "I got nothing left. Like, I got nothing left." She goes, "What do you mean?" So I did report cards all day. I feel like a zombie. My eyes are glazed over than the back of my head. I got nothing left. Navigating this new report card system, entering the information, that intense focus that you have to give to make sure you don't make a mistake, because one mistake could cost you a lot of time later on. It's like, so I had the PD day to do it, and I did it on my PD day, but I was done for the rest of the day. I didn't do any planning. So now I have to, today or tomorrow, I need to focus again on what's happening on Monday with my students. What am I going to be teaching? So how do I create my lesson? And then what are they going to do to practice maybe the skills and understanding that I'm providing them with? Like, what are they going to do? And that's just one layer of it all. And I'm not trying to be a little weenie. Like I'm a professional. I have a job. I'm doing my job. But the way it has to happen right now is slowly breaking down a lot of people. And I'm not scared to say I'm one of those people. At the end of every day, I'm literally like tapped out, but I find a way to refresh, and then I get back to work because that's my job. But seriously, I feel like I'm always just one. You should see. I share my screen with my kids, and usually I turn my camera off when I share my screen just to make sure I'm not using up all the bells and whistles. I want to make sure my computer can do what it can do. And I will show them something and do something, and there's always the one or two kids that raise their hand and say, "What are we doing?" And I literally like I just my hands go to my forehead, and I take a deep breath, and then I begin to explain what we're doing. Or kids come 20 minutes late to the class, and so I politely say, "Hey, you just missed a lesson." "Well, I was doing other things." "Well, what could you possibly be doing? It's a school day, and you're expected to be at school." And hey, here's the thing too. The other half of me knows that the other thing's happening, because as I'm sitting here, my son's in the corner over here getting all sad and upset because he's just been given an assignment. He doesn't know how to start it. So he's losing his mind right beside me while I'm teaching my kids. And then, he'll go bother my wife while she's teaching her kids. So I know other things are happening, but I'm like, the curious side of me comes out, and I'm like, what were you doing that you were away for 20 minutes? I mean, we had a recess right before that. So you've been gone for 45 minutes. "Well, I was just doing some stuff over here, and what are we doing now? Like, how do I do this work?" And I just pause. I just pause, and then take a couple of deep breaths, maybe a swig of water, and then I say to them, "Let me get everybody rolling, and then you and I can talk." And then there's the, there's 50 hands up, and I tell the kids I'm going to go through the hands one at a time, because they've been ordered based on when you raised your hand. And there's always a kid at the bottom of the list, and they turn on their mic and they're like, "Mr. C, Mr. C," and I'm literally talking to another student. I'm explaining to Joey how to do whatever we're doing, and Jimmy's like, "Mr. C, are you there?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm here. I'm talking to Jimmy. Can't you hear me?" And it's like, it's all of that combined on top of like, oh, the kids aren't doing their work, or they're not showing up on time. And none of that's really important in the pandemic. But at the moment, I'm forced to pay the tip because that's my moment. That's what I'm supposed to be doing during that time. And so by the end of that day, there's nothing left.
Yeah.
There's nothing left, but there's more work to be done. So, you know, I told a colleague, I've mentioned it to my boss, like, hey, you can give us whatever you want, but I don't know if people are going to do what you're asking for, because you're either going to have lots of stress leave, or you're going to have people giving you stuff that's late, or just not what you expect, because it doesn't matter compared to sitting in front of the kid trying to teach them about what's happening. Now, I don't know if you're feeling any of that vibe, but I know elementary teachers are. I'm hearing it about it every day.
I am feeling it. I don't think I'm not feeling it in the same to the same degree you are. I think developmentally, both teachers that teach high school and kids that are in high school, the obligation, like that shared responsibility, that sense of responsibility is more, I think, more equitably distributed, because you know, you sort of think of high school students, they should be able to do this. Now that can be fake too, right? Because I even though we have that expectations that because the kids are older, they should be able to do a task, they're running up against the same speed bumps that the teachers are, that you folks are experiencing in elementary. There will be students that, you know, we talked about the Where's Kevin effect. And, you know, the whole Home Alone idea, you get through the lesson. And for whatever reason, like, you're not perfect in checking in with every single kid in the rounds that you want to. And it just so happens that you make it to the last quarter of the lesson where the student should be sort of working on a task and then kind of reaching out to you for assistance. You might be, sorry, I'll stop saying you, me. I have them in the space where they're working on the task. They're in their independent work sort of frame. I'm checking in on their documents, dropping in feedback, having communication in multimodally, stuff's popping up on my chat. Someone's opening up their mic. Someone's using Google Chat. Someone's emailing me. So it's hitting in all these different fronts. I might have multiple Google Meets open. I got breakout rooms rocking. So I've got all these sort of tools of organization to make sure that everyone stays tethered to the lesson. And yet, in the last 5 minutes of class, Kevin pops his head up and he's like, what are we working on, sir? Or are we still in class?
Kevin.
Or when does class start, sir? Like, these are the questions. These are some of the similar spaces that I'm existing in with you, right? A little bit different, a little bit similar, but still the Where's Kevin factor. And I guess for me, the way I process that is that I really have accepted the whole what's in my control, what's not in my control. And if a student steps away, or if a student has a thing they have to take care of, I've just started to take that completely at face value. All right, here's where we are. I've started to figure out quick steps of, one of the things that I've done is what I'll do is I'll keep some post-it notes open, like just an open note paper on my desktop. And when I transition to the next task, or I sort of give what I think is a key bit of instruction, I add it to that post-it note. So then what I'm doing is if a kid just chimes in, sir, what did you mention 15 minutes ago? I take that note that I've written on the notepad and I just paste it right into the chat. And I say, here you go, read this over, and I'll have the link for whatever, wherever they have to go. So I just keep adding basically what they're getting in the chat. Is like what you would be building on an anchor chart or your white erase board. And I just blast them with it. I'm like, here, work through this. And they're like, okay, thanks. And that does work sometimes because it's that quick check-in. Mm-hmm. The other times what I'm doing, and I know you weren't asking for any strategies, but here's where it's saving my bacon. I'll ask the students to do it. I'll say, okay, folks, we need the top five here. And I sort of took your thing.
The top five.
I said, just put into the chat right now, what are the top five things that you folks need to be working on? And the students will populate it. They'll put in like 1, 2, 3. And what's interesting about that, sometimes different kids, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, is not in the order that I put it, but it's a cool way to sort of differentiate how to see the do the task. So often with my lessons, I start with something called a thought fuel, which is just a way to light the kids up. We have some discussions, some literacy, numeracy, and then we have the lesson. And then I have the wrap up. So sometimes kids will put, I'm wrap up number one, still reading the lesson number two, working on the slide deck number three, or the crash kit. It's just a lesson type that I have in my class. And then another kid will have a completely different order. And I like that. So I have my stuff that I just copy and paste in, and other kids will do it too. And I found that really helps for that moment of, you know, the where's Kevin. And then, but that just, that eases the moment, right? A little bit. It just, it's the pressure valve, pops the pressure valve. But then as the teacher, I want to refine the method. And that's sometimes the more frustrating part, because if the same kid is where's Kevining me more than once, then that's where you sort of pop up with your concern. Like, okay, this kid is not benefiting from the class. They're not able to connect with the class. There's something going on over there. Do I need to know what's going on over there? Sometimes you have to know a little bit of it in order to help the kid connect with what's going on in here in the virtual classroom. But I'm always also mindful of probing too deeply, asking too many questions. It's the, it's still, I fall on my own sword and say, what can I do? What can I do to remove the barriers for you? What can I do? What can I do here on the virtual side of this screen to remove the barriers for you? And if the kid comes back and says, I'm hungry all the time. Like, well, that's on you. Like, you're going to have to figure out how to get food. You and your family are going to have to, you know, have a snack system. But if it's something about, you know, the Wi-Fi or technical, or I can't open the link, that's kind of like what we're left with, right? And if those are the barriers that we can do to make sure Kevin doesn't get lost in the airport again, right? That's kind of how I roll on it anyways.
The IT support has just been whacked in terms of me being IT. Like, there's always a kid that says, I can't see what you're showing.
Yep.
And then I say to the other kids, hey, give me a thumbs up if you can see what I'm showing. And then I get all these thumbs up, and I'm like, I say to Julie, I'm like, well, everybody else can see it, so I know it's not an issue on my end. So that's the first thing that we figure out. Is it Mr. C's messing up again, or is it something on your end? And I'm like, well, it looks like it's something on your end. And then they're like, but I can't see. And I'm like, but you can listen. So how about until I can get to you, because I'm not just going to pause everything and do IT. How about you just listen? And now that I know you can't see it, then I will do my best to augment the oral component, and maybe we'll find a way for you to be able to see what I'm doing somehow, right? If I'm using a Jamboard, it's okay because it's all getting recorded or whatever. But sometimes I just, you know, we're working in a Google Doc. I'm using it as the presentation tool, and I'm like, don't worry, I'll just let you see the doc when you get in. And there's a lot of, well, leave the room and come back. Okay. And they think so I've had to say, leave the room. So close, hang up, and then open a new tab and come right back in. But don't wait. Don't wait 15 minutes, because they're going to be like, well, you told me to leave, so I went to get something to eat. No, no. You're going to hang up, close the tab, open a new tab, come back in. That's what you're going to do right now. They're like, okay. And then there's the big old, they love this. I'm like, the shutdown and restart. Okay. I said, we're not going to see you for the next 10 minutes, even though they got Chromebooks, right, that turn off and on instantly. I'm like, okay, we'll see you in 10. And I give them the big salute, and I'm like, shut her down. And so they go through the whole shutdown process, restart the computer. And then they come back, like, it works. I can see everything. And I'm like, awesome.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm good. That's what's happening, but it's every day and it's constant. And it's the pressure of, I'm a teacher and I'm supposed to be teaching, and we're in the middle of a pandemic, but people say they care, but they don't really care. So it's like, there's a lot of messages, you know, coming at you. So I just do what I can. I do what I can. And I tell my wife, do what you can. And that's all that can happen, right? So
yep. One of the best things I did this semester, and it came out of a conversation with my Strat students, and I mentioned before the crash kit,
the crash kit.
Yeah, crash kits. But what started as like a random noticing on my part turned into something pretty valuable, and it ultimately is a part of the students' jargon operating system and strategy toolkit that they have. What I started was we, in the first couple of weeks when we were trying to figure out what digital learning was going to look like, one of our first meetings, everything went wrong. The Wi-Fi, Google wasn't robust enough. Like, there were just so many little moments that were, you know, in some ways hilarious, in some ways frightening, because we weren't into the mix enough yet, so we really didn't know what we had gotten into. They were informative and they were destabilizing, all of that stuff at once, because the tools aren't working, and then you start to catastrophize. Even the most stoic edges of me were getting like ruffled up. I'm like, this, I can't, I, like, you just start glitching like your operating system. And so what we did was we took a couple days, like over a couple days, we talked about what happens if, and we focused on, we turned it into an inquiry question. So we created a I sort of set up a standard question on the front end, but it basically says, what do we do when the internet's down? Actually, I think the first version was, what do we do when the internet crashes, which is how I got to the title of Crash Kit in the next layer of this activity. And we talked about it as a class, like, what are our options? And then we, each of the students, I asked them to make sure that they printed out the slide deck, like take all the slides that we created and print it out and keep it with them somewhere that they could refer to, so that if the internet did go down, we had all these options. And, you know, they were straight up stuff like call a friend, talk to your parent if they're there, like you said, refresh, restart, reboot, right? All those sort of things. We had some instructions on there on how to unplug the Wi-Fi. Like, so we had a bunch of stuff that they could do. And that really did, I'll tell you, like, that was the coolest thing, because then what I used that for repeatedly was the idea of a crash kit, and we built it into the crash kit for in working in groups, the crash kit for asking for an extension, and the final crash kit. We had a bunch of them throughout it, and it became a way for me to, it became a part of their summatives for each of the units, but it also became a really cool discussion point that I thought they're building a toolkit for moving forward. So the last crash kit that we made for this final unit is a, what do we do to stay productive and organized? And they ended up, each student has created sort of like a 20 slider, but in those 20 slides, there's different things about some personality surveys. So they sort of have to, we did some personal interrogation, and at the same time built a tool that was customized for each kid. And then my final thing is, I'm doing exit interviews with the kids. So spending about 20 minutes with each kid on the tail end, 15, 20, and they take me through their slide deck, and we have a discussion around what they're going to take from that slide deck, that crash kit, and use it in next semester. So it's funny, like, that's, I really like how that, there's a real elegance in the sort of synchronicity of what we were suffering with in a lot of ways, exactly what you said your kids are suffering with too, and sort of turned it into something that became a tool. But it also, it's been a really interesting kind of conversation starter with some staff, because when they're saying, I just don't know what to do, I said, well, here, let me share my class's crash kits with you. We built a whole system of way of being when these things happen. I would say as far as the activities that started in calamity, sorry, something that was a calamity turning into something kind of useful. And the kids had all the knowledge to do it and they were collaborative and sharing with each other. So crash kits. And I will tell you, I got to get a prompt out. This whole concept of crash kit actually started long before this, because the idea of a crash kit, the term crash kit, is something that I had experienced 15 years ago. And there was a conversation that I actually had with Matt Aldridge, and we talked about crash kits in education, and what the value of crash kits. And the reason the idea of crash kit came to be, I'm going to circle back to restauranting. I don't know if I've shared this story with you, but back in the day, my last stop in restauranting, I was in downtown Toronto. So I was in downtown Toronto during the blackout. So that, what was the blackout? 2003, 2002?
Something that, like that, yeah.
The big one, right?
Yeah.
So a couple years before that, I don't know if, do you remember when they were building Yonge and Dundas Square?
No.
But you know, it went through a major refurbishment, right? Like there's a whole concert, cultural meeting space that's down there now. So when they were building that, I was working in a restaurant in the Eaton Center. And the thing about working in the Eaton Center is that when something happens in one store in the Eaton Center, like an emergency thing, it happens in all the stores. We were a networked system of alarm. So even, you know, if the fire alarm went off in the north end of the building, we would have a fire alarm in ours, and we kind of had to prepare for something, right? And it was loud. That's why I learned about the science of generalized decibels. And I'm not saying the right thing about it, but basically, whatever space you were in, the volume of that fire alarm had to be equally loud in all corners of the room, right? They want it as a standard. I digress, as I always do. But anyway, so we're in the middle of a lunch service and the power goes out in the whole Eaton Center. Now, in general, we had protocols to kind of deal with if we lost power. But the problem was, it was like at 11:30 a.m. So we were right on the front end of restaurant service. And the restaurant I was in had a live fire grill. So as soon as the power goes out, the HVAC goes off, which is the hood system. And potentially what happens is when the hood system turns off, so a hood system is the thing that draws the smoke and the heat out of the restaurant up to the roof and out vents there. In those hood systems, there's also fire sensors, because you don't want a fire in the hood system or the temperature in the hood system to go up. So there was an issue somewhere around the Eaton Center. It caused all of the power to be shut down in the Eaton Center except for emergency, which also caused our HVAC to go off, which also basically we knew at that point that the heat coming off of the grill. Now, this grill, I would say, was probably about as big as a mini. Like, you look at the top of a mini, like a car, and that was about how big the grill was. And it was a big grill. So that's a big fire that's going on underneath there, and hot, right? Well, it's built hot. We have hot. It was built according to what we need, but it was hot too. So there's no quick way to sort of put that out. You throw water on it, you're filling the restaurant with smoke, especially with no exit for that smoke to go out. So we were just floored. We're like, how do we deal? Like, this is pretty big. We found out that in the construction of Yonge Dundas Square, they clipped a gas line. So that was all the way at the northeast corner of the Eaton Center. We were in the south, almost the most southeast corner down by Queen, but that tripped the turning off of the hydro in the whole building. So we kind of had this experience, I don't know, probably back in 2001 when this happened. People can Google that. Whenever Yonge Dundas Square was being built, we had that experience. So right away we realized, in order to survive that type of a restaurant apocalypse, we needed to put together our crash kit. So our crash kit involved a series of steps to save us, like to basically get the customers out. We had, believe it's funny to even say this now, we had a whole bank of calculators and pieces of paper that were sort of like bill of sale pieces of paper, and we had to reteach the staff how to do old school credit card sliding. You remember the ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. So we had that in the crash kit. Pens, pencils, pencil sharpeners, whiteout, a ton of stuff that was like setting up like your bag for the Rib Fest. This was our bag for the crash kit. But in order to sort of basically protocols to operate safely and shut down and checklists and staff phone numbers and call lists. So when I say the crash kit, they were in multiple kits, right? But the overall crash kit was to shut down safely, take care of staff, take care of food product, and still get our money if any customers were eating. So it was complex, right? And we spent weeks developing this afterwards. We're like, this is going to be really important because this is something that's going to happen outside of our control and no one's going to help us with it to save the business. The blackout rolls around and we were ready. And that blackout that happened again in 2003 was far more problematic than that first one of the gas, because that gas clip, we were back up and running by early afternoon. They figured it out. They capped it. We were good to go. Funny, staff was sent home. So we kept our skeleton crew. So back to that skeleton crew thing. And when the blackout happened in 2003 or whatever, we were ready. We had our crash kit. The thing that we weren't prepared for with that crash kit, though, because I think our restaurant was shut for 3 days. And there's a whole lot of stuff, you know, the coolers in the back. We hadn't built the extended crash kit. We had our short-term crash kit. So this is what was like seated in the back of my mind and not even realizing that it was bubbling and percolating there as a potential framework for our current set. But I think, you know, you circled back to, well, I'll circle back to where you started, like, how am I doing? I've spent a lot of time building crash kits. And I'm building crash kits with the mind that they need to be useful right now. They need to have an analog kind of element to it so that kids can keep learning if they choose to. And they also have to be forward facing. Because I think where we are right now, and I told you, I've mentioned this before, where we are right now in education, even if we get a handle on COVID, our current versions of education, I think because of the investment that we've put into building the infrastructure for virtual learning, I don't believe it's going away anytime soon. So by that measure, I don't think our concerns about learning in this particular environment should go away anytime soon. That was long. Dude, we're at an hour and a quarter. Sorry, I feel like I used up 65, 75% of it.
Nah, no worries. No worries. Maybe this is the perfect time to shut it down then.
I don't know, dude.
You got anything else you want to talk about?
Pathetic fallacy.
Tell me about this pathetic fallacy. I saw you tweet that. Hey, did you see that I claimed the hashtag PodTuber?
I appreciate you've claimed that power, I think, a few times, haven't you?
No, you've claimed PodTubing. Oh. When I look back on PodTubing, you got to it first. I was able to grab PodTuber first. So, I mean, it's just cool that we're using that term. We're using that hashtag. It's kind of fun.
I love, too, that my son, that sort of that little rapport when you're, you know, offering him some thoughts about what it means to be a YouTuber, that he sort of asked about PodTubing, too. So the pathetic fallacy. Pathetic fallacy is the idea that the mood that you're having somehow is reflected in your outside world. So you're in a pissed off mood and it starts, you know what it is? It's the, you know, that, that drawing. And I don't know why Charlie Brown comes to mind, but Charlie Brown walking with his head down, staring at the sky, staring at the ground, shoegazing. And there's just one gray cloud over his head, raining on him.
Yes.
And the truth of it is that you assume an association between the outside and the inside that might not be true. And I think in some ways that the fact that it's raining outside really has nothing to do with the fact that you were sad a minute ago. Mm-hmm. You know, the outside environment doesn't give a damn about how you feel, but we do notice it. And I think that idea of pathetic fallacy, at least right now, I think there's some mistake making going on that we sort of, even if it, here's where I'm going to push the pathetic fallacy, kind of challenge it, is that despite all of these really kind of big set pieces that we crave to figure out and understand as educators, there are kids that are doing well as well. And even though our efforts, even though it feels terrible for some educators on this side of the screen, and I've had those moments as well, during these exit interviews that I'm doing with the kids, I get to spend a good concentrated amount of time talking to them, just talking for like 20 minutes, and they're getting it. The stuff is getting in. They're able to give back to me some of that relationship nourishment that just doesn't translate in the moment of the lesson, but they were there. They were there. They might not have been interacting, but they were there and they heard you. They were there. They did the work. They were there and they were loving you and caring you just as hard as you were trying to sort of love and care for their experience as well. So I think that's the pathetic fallacy in this. I think that's where, you know, we get from that opt out to barbecue and being a dad and you know, providing and caring for the individuals around us, is that we won't always be able to command that whatever's outside of us mirrors what's going on inside of us in the moment that we want it. We can't command and demand the kids to not get up and go for a snack, or you know, we can't command them to always say hi or check in. Mm-hmm. But I will say from experience, walking away from that expectation just a little bit has allowed me to sort of really enjoy the moments that I am having with the kids that are interacting. And these exit interviews have been a very sweet, a super sweet example of the stuff getting in, the good stuff getting in. So, you know, they are getting some of this, Chids. They are. It's just maybe not in the way that we're used to assessing it.
No doubt they're getting it. I just, I'm struggling with putting it together to give it to them.
I know.
That's all. Yep. And it's, I know that there are some teachers that are probably thriving. There has to be, but I'm not hearing from those people. So I'm sure that they're there, but I'm not hearing from those people. And I'm trying to broaden, I'm trying to broaden the people that I'm communicating with. And it just seems like, let's say 90% of the people I'm communicating with who I know taught in school, and some that left right from the beginning of the school year to teach virtual, I'm hearing the same thing. Like, even though they've been virtual for months, there's still these issues that I'm talking about they're dealing with still daily. Planning may have gotten easier because they've made connections with other teachers teaching the same grade. So then they start working collaboratively, which takes the load off a little bit. So there's definitely some ways around it. And your crash kit ideas are obviously great in terms of, you know, having plans in place for different situations. I still think that that this whole experience for a lot of us is so raw. And so because we're in survival mode, we're not thinking crash kits, even though it makes perfect sense to have a crash kit. It's when your emotions are leading you, it's very difficult to stay on top of,
yep,
of like the rational components. So
it like is I have been privileged. There's privilege that I can, that the time and place and sort of like the what I want to say, the complexion of my classrooms and the students that I have afforded me the time and space to be able to develop these things. I understand that. I get that.
For me, I think that as soon as these report cards are done and the IEPs are done, because I have a feeling we're going to be doing this for a lot longer, it's virtual teaching. I think once those things are out of my way, I'm going to have more mental space to focus a little bit more maybe on crash kit type stuff, some rational stuff, but it's still raw. Everything's still raw. So like principals asking teachers for more than just what they're supposed to do for their job, it's like they're going to lose a lot of people. People are shutting down. And so there needs to at least be a conversation around, you know, what's reasonable and what's unreasonable at this point. And it's all perception. So, you know, you could have one staff that are rolling along, but you've got other staffs that are like, leave me alone. Let me teach the things I need to teach every day and survive this. I'm not going to do any extracurricular activities for anybody because my mom's not there. And I'm trying to think about this as from a leadership perspective too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I were a leader right now, how would I be, what could I be doing to help my staff or to stay out of their way? How do I make it clear what is non-negotiable and what is negotiable? Like, that's tough, you know, it's not easy, but hey, that's their job. That's not my job. That's their job. And, but I play with the idea because, you know, I'm interested in leadership and I wonder what it would be like, but.
I have a deep respect for what, Anthony Fauci said recently, in one of his press conferences where he was being asked, cause he's a part of the Biden administration, eh?
Right. Yes.
And he openly called out and he said, I think the question was something effective. What do you notice? What's the biggest difference that you notice between this and the former administration? And he'll say it better than I can. But in essence, what he put in was, he said, with this administration, if you don't know the answer, just say so. And he kind of left it at that. So I think that your question, I love your question about, you know, being an administrator and what would a leader be doing right now? I think what a leader, there's only small moments of it that I can project myself into because I, like you, am sort of, I'm in that space too, thinking about, you know, I'm set up to take the next PQP. So I'm in these conversations about what does leadership look like? That doesn't involve being in the classroom specifically. So often that's interpreted, you know, that could be a consultant position. I mean, it could be principal or VP. There's different spaces that is not direct teacher leadership. So I'm in that space of thinking about those things too. And I think probably a key reflective practice right now, sorry, active practice right now would be admitting that you don't know what to do. And telling that in spaces that aren't safe. Telling it in spaces that are safe. And then, as you kind of mentioned, trying to find some sort of a collaborative approach to figure out new ways of thinking, new tools for moving forward. So for me right now, that's actually the type, it's funny, and it seems antithetical, right? Almost paradoxical. I'm looking for leaders that are openly saying, I don't know what to do next. But I'm working on it, and I'm working on it with these people to try and figure it out.
It's that vulnerability. It keeps popping.
Yeah, right? Totally.
It's the vulnerability of saying, I don't know, but yeah, I'm taking a look. We're gonna do something here about this. That really resonates with me. I do run my class that way. So if we're doing something and a kid says, what about this? I'm like, I don't know. But hey, we're gonna figure it out. Like, we'll keep, it's not, I don't know, let it go. It's, I don't know.
Let's do this.
Let's revisit it. Let me figure it out, or let's figure it out at this other time, or let me ask questions.
And I get that's fatiguing. That's the thing, to be in constant innovation. Like this is the dark side of growth mindset. Like right now is the dark side of growth mindset, to having to keep those filters so wide in order to capture as much data as possible so that you can move forward with kind of like a grasp on where you're at and where you're going. Like, I think this is one of those moments where I've said it before, growth mindset causes, you know, loss of sleep, heart palpitations, cold sweats. And at the same time, the obligation right now, like if you don't know, I don't see any obligation to say why you don't know. And I think sometimes that's what teachers feel like they have to do. That if they dare to say, I don't know what to do, they have to sort of explain it away as why. And I think maybe that why brings out the worst of us, or it has access to the worst of us. Why don't you know that? You're a teacher. You're well-educated. You have privilege. You know your content area. You know the school protocols. Why don't you know this? And I don't know if this is necessarily as often a line of questioning that the community is putting your way. I think it's a mindset that some teachers have. They feel compelled to answer those questions the moment they say they don't know. And I might push back and say, well, what if you don't answer those questions? You just keep grinding away at it. You don't have to say why right away. Probably better off. I don't know who I had this conversation with. I mentioned to, it might have been Beth Lyons. Somebody I talked about this next year of virtual learning is not about the 5 W's. It's about the H. It's mostly about the H. And then a short distance after that, you can do a Y. But I feel like right now is all about the how. How do we do this? We're not going to worry too much about the other letters. We're going to do how do we do this. Maybe get to a why, but mostly how do we do this? Dude, good convo. Not the feel-good convo we normally have.
Nah. But
no. not that we normally have always feel-good conversations.
That's cool art, man. I see mountains and an interesting colored sky. That's what I see. Is that what I'm supposed to see?
I don't know. I was kind of doing the clouds. I was trying to figure out clouds. Mountains work too, though, bro. Mountains work too.
That's what I see.
Eye of the beholder. Eye of the beholder, buddy.
Yeah, well, thanks for a great chat.
Yeah, man.
I guess we just keep rolling along, eh?
Rolling, rolling, rolling. What? We're going to keep rolling, rolling.
This was season 4, episode 20 of the Decoded Podcast. I'm Roland Chidiak. He's Chris Clough. We have no sponsors.
We have no sponsors.
We have no bumper music. We have no like ads. This is it right here, kids.
Yeah, they are welcome to tap and go on our app, our Decoded app in development right now.
In development, I think everything that we have on the side. The kombucha, the shack out back,
eyeglasses.
The eyeglasses, it's all in development.
We also, empathy engines and all that stuff. Everything's been in development. Isn't that wonderful? It causes a lot of stress, though. Like, let's be honest. I am so stressed out about our product line right now. Oh, yeah, the smell of my beard, man care. I love that. Smell my beard. That was that I think is probably one of my favorite products. I would say it's probably sold marginally the best out of any of our products that we have offered. Like just a little bit more. Yeah. I think we were able to sell that smell my beard option. And I even forget what some of the smells were. I think one of them was like
one of them chai.
It was chai. I think the other one was like mesquite barbecue. I think the other one might be coffee breath, maybe.
Maybe. I don't drink coffee, so I wouldn't be. Yeah. That's kind of up your alley.
Well, but we can have that. Chai splash and coffee breath.
Chai splash, barbecue, bold barbecue. I don't know, mesquite, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, smell my beard. That's a good product too.
And then I think often then we have to just have the one that we don't really name, but we let our consumers name. And it's like a completely opaque bottle, and it just says smell my beard, right? It is like the mothership of the products, but we don't
it's the OG.
It's the OG, right? Yeah, this is the mother sauce from which all other products stem.
Can I shift to our books for a minute? We have like the kombucha, we have the
Yep.
smell my beard, we have
Yep.
the empathy engines, eyeglasses, but
Yep.
we also have our books that are
Yep.
currently unnamed
Yep.
and currently for free. All you have to do is watch our YouTube feed and our Twitter
Yep.
feeds, and everything that we would put in the book, you can get for free.
Yep. I what was the title? I forget. Our first title was
Your first title, you, because I don't
Well,
want to take
no.
any of this away from you because this
No.
is your genius.
Dude, you're my ghostwriter on this one. My name's on the front, your content's on the inside. So what is it like? I think it was so long ago we wrote that. I think we wrote this one maybe 5, 6 years ago.
The
It
hay
was
sucker.
like hey, sucka. No, haha, sucka. Thanks for buying my book. You could have found it all in my feed
For free.
for free. Hey, sucka.
And that's the end of that. That's Decoded Podcast for today.
It's never the end of that, but for today,
For now.
yeah, back to dad style, bro. Back to
We
dad stuff.
can't stream all day.
No, we can't.
Okay, peace.